This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. The death of at least 60 reporters in Iraq reminds us of the peril journalists face in war zones. Today we remember one of the 20th century's most prolific war correspondents, a man who for decades seemed to race to all of the world's most dangerous places. Polish writer Ryszard Kapuscinski, who covered 27 coups and revolutions, mostly in the 60s and 70s, died Tuesday in Warsaw at the age of 74. Kapuscinski focused on conflicts in the Third World, telling their stories in news dispatches and in vivid essays and books, in which he used allegory and metaphors to convey the events he witnessed. He came to know Patrice Lumumba in the Congo, Che Guevara in Cuba, and Idi Amin in Uganda. He narrowly escaped death several times. His books include Shah of Shahs about the Iranian Revolution, Another Day about the Civil War in Angola, and The Emperor, which explored the end of Haile Selassie's reign in Ethiopia. Terry spoke to Kapuscinski in 1988.
Did you go looking for all of these 27 revolutions, or did you just happen to be at the right place at the right time?
It was both. I mean, I was working in a very small agency, and that was my advantage, because big agencies, they have correspondents in each country. And I was covering the whole continent of Africa, Latin America, and Asia. So for me, it was always, as for any journalist, to be in a hot spot if something was happening. But in case of Associated Press correspondent or Reuters correspondent, that was just his one chance in the life, because if something happened in Nigeria, for example, he was based in Nigeria. But myself, I was roaming all over the continent. So I was always in those places where something was happening. So it was easy to collect such amount of different sort of revolutions, coup d'etats, home wars, and so on.
Is there something about war and revolution that speaks to your condition?
In a sense that, well, first, the journalist has to be in such a place. So this is his obligation, his profession. But from my own characteristic, is that I like the places which you create an extreme situation for the people, which the people have tested themselves, you know, their abilities, their character. And those extreme situations, those hot situations, has a very strong impact on me too. I feel very well in such conditions.
I want to quote something that you wrote in Shah of Shahs. You wrote, "All books about revolution should begin with a psychological chapter that shows how a harassed, terrified man suddenly breaks his terror and stops being afraid." And you say that that's how revolutions start, that people who have been afraid of the police suddenly stare them back in the eye and they don't budge. And then the confrontation takes place and the revolution starts. You have probably witnessed such beginnings of revolutions. Can you think of an example where that happened, where you saw somebody break out of terror?
That's exactly what this particular situation you are quoting from my book, Shah of Shah. It just exactly happened in Iran when I saw it on my own eyes. With my own eyes. I understand, because, you know, revolution, beginning of revolution is a sort of psychological problem, question. We have a lot of countries in this world which are living in a very poor situation, and they are very tense internal situation, but nothing happened, you know. People are desperate, people are very unhappy, but they don't revolt because they are dominated by fears and unable to break this situation and to control themselves. And the very moment when not one man but the big masses are able to control themselves and to start fighting, that's the beginning of each revolution.
What did you see in Iran that made you write that? What was the event that you witnessed?
This was in Qom, in a small town near the Tehran, when there was an article came down from one of the official Iranian newspapers about which were very insulting to Khomeini at that time. Khomeini was in exile. And being himself from Qom, the people surrounding there and started to fight against very strong police forces. But the very fact that they win this battle, despite all victims and all casualties, this very fact started the whole process in Iran. But this is not only one of the examples of this. We have many of this sort of example all over the world.
You also have seen a lot of revolutions that have gone wrong and that have ended up practicing their own form of tyranny. And you've written that one common theme is the helplessness on the people who serve on the revolutionary committees because they've never been in that kind of position of leadership before.
Well, there are different reasons. I think the main thing is that people are not trying firstly to make revolutions. They are trying all other means of improve their lot, improve their living conditions and improve their situation. But if they fail with other peaceful means, they are just trying to make revolution as a last desperate step. And of course, they are also failing quite often, because most of the revolution are unsuccessful, because most of the revolution are just a change of power, I mean, the change of group of people in the power.
There have been many times when you have been going into a country that's in the middle of a war or revolution, just as everybody who's from that country is trying to flee and go someplace else. What are some of the things you've had to do in order to get in to a situation where everybody else is trying to get out?
Well, I mean, people are trying to escape the dangerous situation. That is very natural and very...
Sure is.
Very, very normal reaction. I mean, it's a human natural reaction. But at the same time, there are some crazy people, some crazy journalists who are just trying to get in. And I'm among those journalists, crazy journalists, and was such a group of 40 or 50 or 60 people all over the world, maybe something like maybe more. But for us, we have another approach to this, where the people who are trying to, first of all, to establish the truth, what's going really on. Because all official reports we get from the governments involved in the war, they are pure lies. I mean, there's a lot of exaggeration, a lot of distortion. And only by journalists to go inside is to establish the truth. He has no other way but to risk his own life and to risk everything just to get in. I was quite often in situations which I was told that, for example, in Angola, that such town is in the hand of the foreign group, fighting group. Then everybody was saying this, but nobody was sure about this. So the only way to find out the truth, to prove how it really is, it was to go there. And to go there, it was to risk your life, you know. I was having such an experience, for example, in Nigeria, during the civil war in Nigeria. Then there was saying that the southern road from Lagos to Benin is a road which you can't pass because it's too dangerous, it's too many roadblocks, too many thieves on the road, you know, people, bandits and guerrilla fighters, everything. But I was not sure about this, and I went with my own car, you know, to find out the truth. And of course it was I narrowly escaped the death because that was really very dangerous. But then after coming back to Lagos, I could report how really it is. Where really is the danger? Where really is the war going on? Where really is the front? But there is, in such an extreme situation, there is no other way.
Isn't there a voice inside you that keeps saying, turn back, turn back?
Yeah, well, there are people who are doing this, but we're continuing this. And sometimes it's also a competition problem. Once I remember where there was a war between Salvador and Honduras in Central America. And we were trying to get with group journalists, international group of journalists from all over the world. There were something like over 50 of us. And we were trying to get to the border between Honduras and Salvador when there was a real war going on. And the road was quite open road. And the forces, military troops, was on the both sides of the road. And the road considered to be under the fire of the both sides. Nobody was able to pass through. But we entered this road, and we're going this road, knowing that we're going straight to the death. But because we're a group of competing people, nobody wants to admit, you know, that he will stay back, you know. Everybody was trying to show himself that he's a brave, good journalist, and he's not worrying about any danger, and he's going. And we're going like a mad, crazy people, something like a few miles, unless somebody not telling openly that he's afraid, but he said, look, I have some heart trouble, I would prefer to stay a little bit. So he started the movement of stopping all of us, you know. And eventually we turned back. But this road, when we are going, everybody knowing that we are doing some crazy thing, but nobody wants to admit this, it was a very typical for this sort of situation.
It sounds like a real journalistic macho.
It is something like that in this. But at the same time, you know, it gives you after that a great satisfaction that you really want. It's the best proof for you because it's authenticity which is important. People said, have you seen this? Yes, I saw it. I was there. And that's what really make your documentation, your report valid.
Do you ever do things like bring objects along that could be used for barter or to bribe people who would otherwise try to steal something from you or mislead you or imprison you?
I remember when we were trying to get to Zaire, to Congo Brazzaville at that time, to Congo Kinshasa at that time. We used to have some cigarettes, you know. The army was very demoralized at that time, and they were not allowed you to get through without giving them something. So we had a lot of cigarettes and drinks and something like that just to give to these people. But it's not quite often. I will say that mostly, in most cases, people are rather helpful, rather hospitable. Once they know that you really are doing the job, you know, that you really are somebody serious who really wants to know, who really is wants to support their case. They're rather helpful and hospitable, and I think I always was in getting along with in such a situation with such a people.
For about 20 years, you were writing for the Polish press agency. Now, would people make certain presumptions about you and about which side you might be on because you represented an agency from a communist country?
Well, it works both ways, you know, because we're being a group of foreign correspondents, for example, in Africa. We're all cooperating a lot. It was a sort of competition, but at the same time, cooperation. It was not working in Europe or it was not working in a developed country. We're working, all of us, in extreme situation. We have to share, you know, the food, the little food we had. We have to share a little water we had. We have to share an old car we had. So we're cooperating very much so. Sometimes, and this cooperation was one of the examples which maybe that will be time I want to write something about this, how wonderful it can be. Because when there was, for example, right-wing coup d'etat, my friends from the Western press was sneaking me in, saying, well, this man is okay, just let him in. And when it was a left-wing coup d'etat, I was helping my friends from the Western country to sneak in, say, well, this man is fantastic, just let him in. And it was a lot of such examples. I remember that during the Zanzibar Revolution, the small island in the eastern coast of Africa, that was such a revolution in 64, and there was my colleague from Agence France-Presse, and there was a television man from ABC, and they had a small plane. But I knew the people who made this revolution, you know. So they came to me, but the island and the airport and the island was completely closed. Nobody can enter the territory of Zanzibar. So they came to me and they said, Richard, we have a small plane, but we can't get in. And I said, okay, let's make a deal. I will talk with these people there who made this revolution, but you will take me to the plane because I have no money to share for you know to share the expenses of this. And I spoke with the control tower in Zanzibar. They said, okay. I said, there's fantastic people coming here, and just be quiet. Nothing will happen. We'll write good stuff about what's going on here. So they allowed the plane to come in. It was a small Cessna plane. And we came in and we're the first journalists who gives the news from this revolution.
What made you want to travel and write about other countries instead of writing about Poland? Because let's face it, Poland's recent history has been very, very interesting. And journalists from around the world have tried to go to Poland to write about that.
Exactly. I'm meeting always. I have a lot of friends coming to me. It's very nice they are visiting me, but I'm some sort of travel agency in Warsaw. But yes, but I'm not specialist on this. I believe in specialization. I believe that journalism is also a profession which requires specialization. And my experience, my life experience was that I was in my country in a unique position, unique situation, be able to know, to see, to witness this tremendous historical event of the second part of the 20th century, which was the birth of the Third World. That is, we in the second part of during of this century, there is a completely new map of the world. World has been created, and I think being a witness of this fantastic, incredible event, I have to write something about this. I'm living in Warsaw. I'm writing in Polish, but I think that my contribution to the Polish literature and to other literature is just to exploit my experience, and doing this not in the only purely journalistic way, because that is a lot of journalists who are writing about the Third World countries, but using also having this opportunity that I can write not only just cable, press cable, you know, a small article, but also to write about atmosphere, about climate, about culture.
And about the psychology.
About psychology, about all this, you know. So I think that if I will just drop it to write about Poland, you know, I will left something unexploited and unwritten, which, in my opinion, it's worse to be written, to be I was, you know, a witness to something very important. So this is how I understand my role and my vocation, my mission.
Let me tell you what I find hard to understand about you from what I know about you. Now, I know you grew up during World War II, and for the first 7 years of your life, you lived in poverty. There was never food, or at least never much of it. You didn't have shoes during most of your childhood. It was hard to get any kinds of clothes. You lived under very, very difficult circumstances. You saw a lot of death around you. And so the war ends, you grow up, and what do? You follow one war to another, going from one revolution to another. I would think that someone who grew up as a child in war would be so happy to try to put that behind them and to live as comfortable a life as possible as an adult.
Well, it's probably something of the Freud in this. From your childhood, you know, you left your childhood, your experience in this age, in this period of life, is leaving some marks on your psychology, on your character. And it makes that you feel at home in such a situation. It means that you understand the situation. And living, for example, in my childhood, living in poverty, I understand the people living in poverty. I understand people living in Ethiopia, in Africa. I know what it means to be hungry. I know what to mean to feel cold, and so I can communicate with these people, and I can understand what they feel and what they think. So it makes me to be at home, being in third world countries, the situation of great comfort, of having everything at hand, makes me a little bit uncomfortable. I feel better being there, being in a very simple surrounding, among very simple people, and trying to say something in the name of them, of their name, you know, to say how they feel, how they suffer, to say about their pains, about their hopes. That's how I understand my role and my profession. I don't treat my profession as a simply the way of writing or making money. I understand it also as a sort of social work and also a sort of mission.
Do you feel that growing up during the war and being surrounded by suffering made you more fearless?
No, I don't think. I think every people know what fear means. I will say that no, because the difference, every people are people who, every people suffer from fear. You know, it's a very painful experience. I never laugh at it. I think the difference is only between the people, that there are some people who knows how to dominate fear, and those who are defenseless against the fear. And that's the only difference. But everybody...
So you can dominate your fear?
That's the only... Sometimes.
Right.
Sometimes, you know, only ambition, which is stronger than this. Sometimes I know that I'm in a very bad situation and I fear very much, but I think I have to be there. And that's what leads me.
Polish writer and war correspondent Ryszard Kapuscinski speaking with Terry Gross in 1988. Kapuscinski died earlier this week. He was 74.